You are listening to the Marty Leeds Mathematical Radio Hour, where we discuss myth, math, spirituality, philosophy, and much, much more. www.thesyncbook.com. Greetings and salutations, everyone. Welcome to the podcast once again. I hope everyone is having a fine day or evening or morning, whatever time it is, wherever you are. This podcast is dedicated to exploring science, spirituality, philosophy, and everything in between, and I am really excited for the next couple of months because I have just a great bunch of guests lined up that I know you will enjoy getting a chance to hear from, so please stay tuned. Just a quick announcement before we get started. For those of you that are in the Great Pacific Northwest, please don't forget about the Olympia Sync Book Summit this next weekend, which is August 8th and 9th in Olympia, Washington. A great group of speakers and events are planned. There will be presentations from Rodney Asher, who's the filmmaker of the movie Room 237, Evan James Pilato from Portland's own Media Monarchy, Joe Alexander from Apophenia Films, Scott Onstaff from Secrets in Plain Sight, as well as a presentation from myself and many, many more. All the info is available on the SyncBook site. That's just www.thesyncbook.com/OLY2014. So that's thesyncbook.com, OLY2014. You can go there, get your tickets, and don't miss out on what is sure to be a really great conference. So tonight's guests on the show are author of The Quest for Gnosis and Born Again to Rebirth, Gabriel D. Roberts, and the musical guest is the Southern Wisconsin Bluegrass Trio, The Fingers. This show is brought to you by The Sync Book Radio. Check out all the wonderful podcasts, 42 Minutes, Always Record, The Middle Chamber, and Synchronize. More information about Sync Book Press, Sync Book Radio, or Sync Book events can be found at www.thesyncbook.com. If you like this podcast, please share it with your friends and please support it by becoming a donor. You'll find the donation links under each episode on the website and consider setting up a monthly charge as it helps us keep the lights on and helps keep our microphones humming. And as always, thank you for your support. Our guest tonight is Gabriel D. Roberts. Gabriel D. Roberts is a theological scholar, researcher, and public speaker that specializes in discussions about the nature of perception and belief. After 27 years of passionate searching and study, Gabriel stepped away from his long-held Christian faith into a more expansive and fluid worldview. The details and reasons are cataloged in his book, Born Again to Rebirth. His latest book, The Quest for Gnosis, explores the roots of belief, the power of the ecstatic state in one's spiritual life, and the means by which a deeply satisfying spiritual life may be achieved outside of the bonds of dogma. Within The Quest for Gnosis, Gabriel interviews 20 of the brightest minds in this field of study, including Dr. Rupert Sheldrake, Graham Hancock, Daniel Bellelli, Peter J. Carroll, Dr. Rick Strassman, and many, many more. He is currently at work on his next book, The Hermit, and he also writes for Vice Magazine, Disinfo.com, and RealitySandwich.com. So without further ado, let's get pious with Gabriel Roberts. Gabriel, thanks for coming back on the show, man. I got to apologize to you. We already did this once, and I botched the recording again. And for the people that are listening to this, this is the second time I've done this. So hopefully I will get my shit together here. But so I just want to say thanks again for coming on.
Of course. Yeah. Anything for you, Marty.
If you don't mind, I want to read an excerpt from your book, Born Again to Rebirth, to start the show, if you don't mind. Read the book, absolutely loved the book, man. I really enjoyed it, and I highly recommend it to the people, to the listeners. It's actually a very short read. I think I read it in about two sittings, so just loved it. But this comes from Born Again to Rebirth. It says, one morning in school, a teacher relayed to us the way that you can spot a cult. In Christian circles, cults are groups that claim to be Christian but do not adhere to the doctrine set out by the anti-Nicene Creed. We were told stories about many people who were riddled with guilt and harassed by cult members and even threatened in various manners. It was all very shocking and scary to consider that this sort of thing was going on. The teacher laid out the descriptors of a cult. A cult will welcome you at first, asking nothing of you, but will often give you things you essentially have a need for. Food and shelter are often provided. A cult will tell you that their version of the truth is the only way and that only their leader is the true person to get you to heaven. A cult will pressure you to give them money in increasing amounts and will find ways to make you feel the absolute need to give money to them. A cult will threaten you that if you attempt to leave the group, your soul will be eternally punished. If you leave the cult, the members will turn their backs on you and will take every opportunity to slander your name and reputation. When I heard the descriptions listed above, I realized that the Christians around me behaved exactly in this way. At the time of this transition in my life, I lived in tremendous fear that I was going to burn in hell. even for having doubt in my faith. In retrospect, the above description of a cult could quite easily be the condensed version of how I was treated when I outwardly rejected Christianity. I was threatened, harassed, blacklisted, and exiled. The church itself was a cult. And that comes from your book, Born Again to Rebirth. Can you talk, can you give us a little background into where you came from as far as like your evangelical Christian upbringing and the transition and evolution to you now?
Sure, yeah. You know, I grew up evangelical Christian. I mean, from the, as soon as I could understand speech, the doctrine was fed to me, and that's the way I grew up. That's what my family believed, and so that's what I believed. This is very common and very natural for any child. You know, when your parents tell you something, you believe them. That's mm-hmm. the way it is. So, that's what I grew up knowing. And when a young person is told how the world works, they just adhere to that. And so I ran with it. You know, if this is the way the world works, if these are the rules of engagement, then I need to abide by that and continue through it. And I did. I gave it all that I had. And for 27 years, I devoted my time and energy as a missionary. I spent my summers on missionary trips. I was in Christian music groups trying to promote and spread Christianity. I was a junior high school minister. You know, I really went for it.
So, yeah, and you didn't just believe it. You embraced it.
I embraced it, and I, unlike many Christians, I actually read the Bible from cover to cover you studied it daily and so on and so forth. So it wasn't like, and I got my degree in theology from Seattle Bible College, which is a Pentecostal institution. So I put in the work mm-hmm. and I was devout and I made every effort to follow through with my beliefs in this regard. As things progressed, I began to see some flaws in the basic doctrine, and primarily things about the loving nature of God, for instance. You know, I when my son was born, I was the first person to hold him, you know, and see him, you know, there in the little incubator thing, and I looked at him and I thought, would I ever set him on fire if he did something that I didn't like, or would I ever consider myself too pure for him? Or him too impure to be in my presence, so much so that I would set him on fire. And it was a resounding no, I wouldn't. No matter what he did, you know, he's my son, he's my child. And I felt the same way when my daughter was born. And as time progressed, that particular thing really dug into me. Like, how can it be that I, being a flawed, ridiculous man, can love my kids enough to never ever even conceive of the idea of setting my children on fire, for instance? And how can that be that God, who is endlessly loving, endlessly compassionate, would not only do that, but do it for eternity and do it for pretty much the majority of humanity? And you know, then I looked in Romans chapter 15, where the Apostle Paul talks about how there are vessels made for destruction and there are vessels that are made for glorification. Those vessels, which he's referring to, are us, our people. Mm-hmm. And essentially the comparison is that God can destroy whatever he wants because he made it. And the ones he destroys, the people he destroys, are the ones that they're destroyed just to show the people who aren't destroyed just how good they have it. And it's shocking.
And fairly morbid, right?
When I read that, I actually was in Bible college at the time. I went home and cried. I was totally distraught. And that's just one example. I mean, I could give dozens of examples. There's, you know, verses throughout the Old Testament where God says, "Behold, I am a jealous God. You shall have no other gods before me." You know, all of these allegories for being cheated on, basically, that Jehovah goes through in prophetic texts and throughout. And all of that stuff is very anthropocentric. It's very person-based. Mm-hmm. It's as if God was just a gigantic, really crabby man. And over time, comparing that with how I viewed my children and viewing the way the God of the Bible views his children, it seemed really lacking. It seemed actually evil. And the more I thought about it, the more evil it became and the more ridiculous it became. And then juxtaposing that with societal changes and views and not being so hidden away or kind of put in that bubble as many people who are in fundamentalist groups are, once I sort of peeked outside of my own bubble, I started to realize that there were opinions and thoughts that I was more congruent with than the biblical ideas. In fact, the warmongering nature of things in American Christianity especially just didn't make any sense to me. And the whole not caring for the poor, you know, like a lot of these things just didn't make any sense to me. And so putting those things together, you know, I got to a point where, you know, I'd come across a Bible verse where God is telling the Israelites to go slaughter an entire people group, and not only the soldiers, but the women, the children, the infants, the oxen. Like, make sure that you've just completely decimated everything. And so, and there's even verses that go so far as to talk about, make sure you slash open the bellies of pregnant women and dash the heads of the babies against rocks. I mean, mm-hmm. It's very specific. it's not a misinterpretation. It's direct. And reading stuff like that, I just kind of was like, this isn't God. I had experienced and known God, or what I would much more broadly term as perhaps the universe. I don't make any assumptions because my assumptions previously were wrong. Mm-hmm. However, there was a presence, there was a feeling, there was something good, something divine that did occasionally come to me that I felt, and it wasn't the same as what I was being told about. And it caused a schism. It caused a schism in my first marriage, and it brought me to a drastic change. And when I actually came out, so to speak, as a non-Christian, it was pretty hard. It's pretty hard because all of my friends were Christians. All, like, everyone I knew up to the age of 27, basically, you know, people were calling me, threatening me, sending me malicious texts. All kinds of really messed up stuff was going on. And because I had split up with my wife, who remained and still is a fundamentalist Christian, you know, that kind of just added fuel to the fire. And so I really was in a bad position, and I didn't really have anywhere to go. And part of the reason why I wrote Born Again to Rebirth is that there are some people who know that what they've been believing for a long time is probably BS. Mm-hmm. And they're scared. And I was scared. And I was lost. And that's where they are. And I know that this is true because Born Again to Rebirth has been out for almost 2 years now, and I still get emails at least once a week, oftentimes much more than that, of people writing saying, thank you for writing this book. And the approach I made on this was not an approach of, you know, your religion is wrong because science, because Richard Dawkins says so, or because Christopher Hitchens says so. I did it from my own personal experience, because faith is a personal, heartfelt thing. And, you know, it's so much emphasized that there are people like Joyce Myers who actually, you know, promote not using logic because it's a tool of the devil and things like that. It's like
just a straight insanity.
It's, yeah, craziness. But so yeah, it was really rough growing up in that and then leaving it and then not knowing what to do. And this is why people stay. This is why people don't change, because it's scary. And man, what worse threat is there than that of being set on fire for all of eternity? That's pretty like infinite. You know, it's like, okay, well, if you're wrong about this, just so you know, all right, fine, go for it. But if you're wrong about this, you're going to be like just melted in napalm basically for the rest of eternity, and no one will love you, and you will be in utter darkness where there is weeping and gnashing of teeth. But yeah. Look, I hope you're right. And so that's like the ultimate threat, right? And so those threats are easily carried out. And when you think about the mindset that somebody has to have in order to accept that, that's why it's so easy to be like, oh, those people are not Christians, bomb them. Those babies, whatever, God doesn't like them, or, you know, they're not God's people, right? And mm-hmm. We see that with the present conflict in the Middle East, you know, this kind of blind loyalty to Israel because they're God's chosen people. But to me, in some ways, that's quite racist to say we're set apart, we're put apart. And this fuels the us versus them thing, which I have a chapter in the book. I talk about that. And I talk about how George Bush, when he went on to tell us we were going to war, he used very Christian-y terms. And he told us all that he talked to God. And as a Christian at the time, I was like, oh, well, let's do this.
Yeah.
And so I guess my reasons for writing Born Again to Rebirth have a lot to do with not only our own personal life and how we view ourselves in relation to the rest of the universe and in relation to God, however you want to pose that or phrase that. A lot of it has to do also with how we're being used, and it still goes on to this day, and it's really unfortunate. But I think that by telling my story, by sharing what happened, by walking through the progression, I was just as devout as anybody out there listening who still is a Christian. I did the studying, I read the books, I learned Koine Greek so I could read the Bible in the New Testament in the original language. I'm not a dummy. I put in the time and effort and energy.
You're walking the walk and talking the talk.
Right? And I've gone on from that, and it feels to me like people have stopped and gotten comfortable because they feel like they understand how the world works, and they have enough catchphrases and enough, you know, logically fallacious ways of going about seeing the world and saying things that they can justify virtually anything. And I know the arguments, so there's nothing new that I'm hearing from Christianity that's revolutionizing the way I see things, as far as that's concerned. And because of that, the fundamentalist view of Christianity is absolutely damning and dangerous, and really will keep humanity as it is. It's one of the devices, this monotheistic viewpoint, which Islam and Judaism and things like that still promote. It promotes patriarchal society. It promotes domination. It promotes that guy's not us, so we should kill him. And I know that that isn't everyone, that there are many people who are naturally peaceable, and I'm naturally peaceable too. But when I promoted that, I promoted both the good and the bad of it, because the book, read as it is, says that stuff. Mm-hmm. Says kill those people. It says they're not as good as you. It says, you know, even Jesus is like, you know, I no longer call you slave, I call you friend. But that's with the presupposition that we are slaves.
Sure. Yeah.
It's just as if you had a slave back in the 1800s in the South and were like, well, no, I don't even say mean things to my slave. I call him friend.
Yeah.
It's still slavery.
Yeah.
So this whole idea that it's not dangerous, it's just It's ludicrous, and it's extremely damaging for the future of humanity. And, you know, a great example would be the way that we view the Book of Revelation as fundamentalist Christians is it promotes an attitude of, well, Jesus is coming back at any time. So why would it matter if we fracked? Let's frack it up. Let's go for it.
Sure.
This is ours to use. God gave this for us.
It can be our trash heap if we want, right?
Exploit it. Yeah. And that's the attitude. And again, I know that because I believed it. I thought it. Yeah. And I was there. I was totally in that sort of mindset. And when I came out of that mindset, I was absolutely horrified.
Yeah. So when you left Christianity, not only when you left Christianity, I mean, you divorced yourself from all your family, all your friends, basically everyone you knew, and that kind of plunged you into this sort of darkness and depression, right?
Yes.
Yeah. You call this the dark year in the book, which I liked a lot. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, and so can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah. You know, when you build your entire life on something or someone, you know, it's different for everybody. But that one thing for me was my Christian faith. My, you know, there are verses in the Bible that talk about how we are slaves to Christ. It is not I, but Christ that lives through me. Mm-hmm. This is, to some, there is a kernel of spiritual truth in that by doing this, it's a disillusion of ego, which is good. But it's a disillusion of your ego through subjugation to a greater ego or another kind of ego. And that ego is the Jehovah God paradigm, mm-hmm. which is extremely limited. As I've just explained, we know some of the limitations there. When I left that, I had no identity. I literally had no identity. I was in a Christian rock band. I quit that band. I was married. And now I was no longer married. I had all of these Christian friends at church and elsewhere, everyone I knew, and now I didn't have them. So when everything's taken away, who are you? And that's the real question that came about. I didn't know. And because of that, I found new friends. And the new friends that I found were in bars, and they weren't judgmental, and they liked to have fun. And I didn't have fun for a really long time. And so in many ways, things that I explored and did, you know, through experimentation were things that, you know, people normally do in their, you know, their early 20s and things like that. But there I was at 27, like, oh, well, this is new and this is interesting. And what happened, you know, through a series of friendships and relationships, I got drawn into the drug scene and developed a cocaine habit and all of that. And the thing about drugs like cocaine and narcotics like that and alcohol is that they subdue your feelings, or they subvert your feelings. They squash them down. They kind of keep them hidden. Sure. And the problem is it's kind of like smashing an overfilled garbage bin. Like you can put all the garbage in the garbage bin, but at some point there's too much garbage. And then you spend your time smashing it down. And once you get to that point, at some point you got to empty the trash. But when you don't, and you're applying more pressure and you're pulling down on that lid, the more you put in there and the harder you put it down, the harder it's going to spring back open. And that's what happens. That's why the come downs are such a bitch, is that if you don't drink, then all of your thoughts that you've been avoiding come back to you. If you're not numb from cocaine, mentally numb, all of those feelings come back. And then you don't even have the proper physiology to deal with it. So it's kind of a double whammy. But for a time, the drug crowd was my church. The drinking crowd was my church. Those were my people. We had our rituals. We had our meeting times and places. We had things to do together. All of those things... We gossiped, you know what I mean? Like, it was pretty much church. And so it was very interesting once I realized that was the case. It was just a different kind of thing. And that really brought me to realize how all of us are kind of feeding this sort of monster, this consumptive monster that's more than just a consumer of goods. It's a consumer of people. It uses things to occupy our mind because our mind is always running and changing and plotting and scheming and fearing death and hoping for the future and regretting the past. All of these things are going on, and we just want it to shut up. And we don't want to actually do the work that it takes to do that properly. And because of that, we find something or someone, anything to quell that, you know, that dis-ease, that lack of comfort that we feel, that what would have been termed in my Christian years as the God-shaped hole. And that's a real thing, but it's not a God-shaped hole. It's something bigger than that. And I say that in terms of the God-shaped hole being the monotheistic God paradigm, the idea that it's just another fix of sorts. And one thing that I realized is that I needed to get rid of all the fixes. And, you know, I'm still in the process of that. I mean, sure. That's we're built for fixes. You know, I don't drink anymore, but now I'm like, oh, there's some Triscuits. Maybe I'll go buy some Triscuits. You know what I mean? Like, I
yeah, yeah.
something. And then when I think about it, I'm like, wait, I don't need that. Why am I doing this?
It's escapism from the thing that you really need to, the core that you really need to get to, right? Because, I mean, and the escapism becomes food, drugs, ideologies, yeah. et cetera, right?
Well, yeah, and ideologies are great. You know, I find myself often frustrated with people who have similar stances as myself, who have a particular slant on things, and we all do. And one of the biggest challenges that we have is seeing eye to eye in this and being able to be agreeable. And, okay, what if everything that we ever wanted came true? Well, we'd still have to deal with the ickiness of who we are. And the boogeyman, the Illuminati, the, you know, whoever, pick your evil people, they're out there. And, you know, there's enough actual evidence to show that, yes, corporate interests are screwing with us. Religious interests are screwing with us. Our government is screwing with us. All of these entities are doing this, but those entities are built up of people who have the same issues that we have the same problems that we have. They're scared. They need money. They have kids. Their teeth are rotting out. They need to go to a dentist. You know, all of these things are going on. These big monsters are made of people. And because of that, we're not seeing things properly. So our ideologies can get in the way just as much as a religion or any other thing. And when we blindly follow that, or we fool ourselves into thinking that what we're doing is perfect and noble, that's just as bad. Humility, getting embarrassed, being caught being wrong is a really good thing because, for instance,
ego dissolution, right? Helps turning the trash can over.
Yeah, when I left Christianity, I realized how very wrong I was, and I was sure of it. I was sure of it for a very long time. And now when I say what things are, I don't say what they are. I say they may be. They sure. might be. It seems that this is the case.
That reminds me of Robert Anton Wilson's Maybe Logic.
I'm totally ripping him off, right?
Yeah. Now. Oh, yeah. I mean, he's totally correct. I think, you know, it's like people are so sure of themselves that they have the one true, you know, right way, and yet really, I mean, he even says, I think in that film, you know, belief systems is best abbreviated with BS, right?
Yes. And that's exactly true. We have these things going on, and Robert Anton Wilson is great because what he does is he clearly shows us, hey, you have your own reality tunnel. The way that you see the world is not actually how the world is. The picture that you have, the image that you have in your mind of every person you know is an inaccurate and incomplete vision. Mm-hmm. That means that you're making assumptions about other people, every single person you know, based upon the information that you have, the information that's given to you, the information you choose to believe or not. And so celebrities, scholars, teachers, lovers, all of these people are not really who we think they are. we can never truly perfectly know a situation unless we could possibly see every facet of that. So what do? We have to do our best to use our best empirical knowledge and couple that with our own intuition and try to come to good conclusions, and still at that realize that we could find ourselves to be dead wrong. Imagine if every scientist 150 years ago was like, okay, guys, we're done with science. We got this figured out. We're done. No mm-hmm. more. We're all just going to go sit down now. Because we figured it out. And that obviously hasn't happened. But really, I think the biggest realization that we need to have is that the universe, that information, all of that is limitless, and that it is not stationary. It's not standing still. As Dr. Rupert Sheldrake has said, he likes to view the laws of nature more as tendencies rather than laws. Because the idea of a law goes back to monotheism, which modern science came from, or had its roots and structure built in. And so those kind of edifices are sort of calcified in still our present thinking. So our radical openness coupled with our logic and our ability to reason properly, all of those things have to work together, and mixing that with our intuition, our hunch, our faith. There is a room for mysticism in that as well, but understanding each other and understanding that our ideologies are our BS, our belief systems are limited, I think is really integral, because without that we're sunk. We're going to go from one delusion to the next, and it's really challenging.
this openness that you're talking about was, I mean, one of the ways that you gained that was through your own psychedelic experiences after you had left Christianity and sort of went into this whole drug culture at one point. And of course, we talked last time about the difference between what, narcotics and plant hallucinogens and that sort of thing, which maybe we could touch on a little bit of that. But one of the tools was psychedelics, right?
Absolutely. And honestly, in all honesty, I believe that and there is evidence for this. You can read Graham Hancock's excellent book, Supernatural.
Fantastic book.
In which he talks about the history of psychedelic use in mankind. And he presents some very good evidence for it. For instance, hypnagogic patterns being laid out in some of the oldest human writing or anything at all. You know, there are these cave paintings, 30, 40, 50, 60,000 years ago, in which we see hypnagogic patterns that you only see during psychedelic experiences.
Can you explain what hypnagogia is?
Hypnagogia is it's very strange. It's when you have your eyes closed during a psychedelic experience, you often see tremendous patterns that seem far more advanced than anything that we could possibly put onto a computer, for instance, or onto a television screen to relay to us. And technology is getting better. But a good example of rampant hypnagogia might be the artwork of someone like Alex Gray, where he is very well shown these sort of interlacing patterns that blend between our reality and other realities. And those patterns are very specific and geometric in nature. And so when you see these in paintings, cave paintings from people who are supposed to be, so primitive that, they hadn't even, they just discovered fire and things like this, and they're making these things, this points to us having had a very long-term relationship with plant hallucinogens, with psychedelics, entheogens, as they're often called. And with that, really, that's the precursor to religion. And in many ways...
Yeah, when you, I don't mean to stop here, but when you were talking about hypnagogia and you were seeing sacred geometric, patterns and things like that, this is something that's very, very common within the psychedelic experience. Then you see that it's like, well, could this be tied to sacred geometry? That one of the ways that they understood that sacred, that geometry was sacred, if you will, is through this process of, right, the integration of these plant hallucinogens in their,
That's
their life.
Correct. And there are...
And isn't, I'm sorry, don't we have cannabinoid receptors in our head too?
Right. We have things built in to us that are made for this.
Exactly. Yeah.
And in fact, as is fairly common knowledge these days, we are all holding a Schedule 1 hallucinogen in our pineal gland, known as DMT, dimethyltryptamine. I highly recommend the book, DMT, the Spirit Molecule. And we have built-in psychedelics.
Yeah.
It's not, to separate us from psychedelics is ludicrous. Dennis McKenna, Terrence McKenna's brother, said that he finds it incredibly frustrating to talk about people being on drugs or not being on drugs, and drugs are bad. And he's like, we're made of drugs. We are entirely...
You're a bag of drugs, yeah.
We are entirely comprised of drugs. And all we're really doing is, in some ways, changing our channel. Even with narcotics, as I explained last time we talked, those narcotics in their basic form do have a purpose and a reason. In the Andes, people chew coca leaves to help them breathe better in high altitude. And it's a far cry from smoking crack on a street corner in urban America or something like that, or doing cocaine or things like that. And, the opium poppy has medicinal effects. And if you're a terminal cancer patient in horrendous amounts of pain, that's about the only thing that's going to help you relieve your pain. So what we have is a true abuse of something that does have a purpose and a reason for being around. And even the idea that my friend Hamilton Morris has explained this most thoroughly and very convincingly, that there's this notion among kind of the hippie burner psychedelic community that says, oh, well, because it's a plant, because it's natural, that's the right thing. But we found through really the work of people like Sasha Shulgin, who recently passed, that we can make new things, through chemistry that can be helpful, nootropics and all kinds of great hallucinogens that can be helpful. And this is an area of research that could be really helpful to us and help us. But since there is this sort of massive fear of the psychedelic that's been promoted by people who are in control, it's really difficult. And the question is, if psychedelics were around and the psychedelic experience was directly tied to the very first religion, which is shamanism, then why is it so frowned upon? And the reason is that if we had things put into our own hands, if we were given the autonomy to realize, for instance, that you don't need to go to a church to have somebody tell you what a book says that was about someone else's psychedelic trip report, you would have to face yourself, because psychedelics offer you a mirror. They show you the good and the bad, and that's why people have bad trips. They get scared. They don't want to face themselves. They haven't dealt with their demons, and we all got a truckload of those. So it's just like this endless thing of, well, it's too much to have to talk about. Again, we come back to this idea of not making the effort. And this is where gnosis comes in, I think, is gnosis is experiential knowledge of a mystical nature. It is you doing it yourself. I've explained it on other occasions. It's kind of like pizza. You could read a book about pizza. You could see pictures of pizza. You could watch an instructional video on how to make pizza. You could you could get other people that you've known talk about pizza, but until you've tasted pizza, you don't know pizza. You don't have gnosis of pizza. And because of that, you really don't have a point of reference, and you don't have a way to have an opinion on that sort of matter. And so when people completely write things like psychedelics off, one, they are increasingly finding themselves on the wrong side of scientific discovery. For instance, we're finding that hallucinogens are greatly helping people who are terminal cancer patients, who are suffering, and soldiers coming back with PTSD are recovering through psilocybin, through LSD. These are powerful things that can be very helpful to us. And when done in the right time and place, respectfully and thoughtfully, they can have a tremendous effect on us. And this is what I believe, and I recognize it is my own BS, my own belief system. I believe, as I was explaining with Graham Hancock's book Supernatural, that God-shaped hole, so to speak, is actually a psychedelics-shaped hole. It's a reason why we're drawn to substances so strongly, because we had developed a symbiotic relationship with an intelligence that seems to operate through the psychedelic experience. And if that is the case, or if it just unleashes some other aspect of that's already in our own mind, just like fuel makes a car run, it doesn't really matter. But what does matter is the transformational experience, that sense of unity and wholeness and interconnectedness that we're finding out every day with new scientific discoveries is the case. We are all interconnected. But to feel that on a very real, more real than real level is absolutely crushing to religious BS, yeah. to fundamentalism in all of its forms. And this is why it's just as equally dangerous to kind of the Dawkinsian model of the way that the world is as it is to the fundamentalist Christian model or Islamic or so on and so forth. So it's really important. And for those who are not into it or excited about it, there are other means to achieve ecstatic states. And this is what I discuss in my most recent book, The Quest for Gnosis. I interview over 20 different scholars, teachers, writers, personalities, television and radio personalities, talking about their different views on Gnosis and how they achieve it in their own life. And I offer it in such a broad spectrum because we don't know. We need each other. We need to have discourse. But what I do show in The Quest for Gnosis is a common thread throughout every one of these people, whether they are atheists, whether they are extremely devout in their particular religious views. All of them have a common thread, and that is gnosis, experiential, direct knowledge that comes from actually doing it, from actually trying it. And we live in so much fear. We're programmed with so much fear. And it's such a mountainous, awful thing that we have to go through because we have a machine that's kind of running on its own now, in which we're subjected to advertisements that are lies. We're subjected to news that is full of lies. We're subjected to views of how our body should look and all of these sorts of things. And they're all manufactured. It's somebody else's view of the world being thrust upon us. And we're not given the proper tools to utilize logic and reason. We're not given the proper tools to really test things out. We're not even allowed to trust our gut. We're told, no, this is the way it is. This is what you got to do. You can't think that way. And that's why, as Terrence McKenna talked about, funny ideas, we shouldn't be having those funny ideas. So while we promote creativity and progress and all of these things, we actually, as a society are shunning those things by not allowing people to, for first and foremost, take over their own spirituality, which if there's anything more personal than that, I don't know what there is. So from that perspective, how can we move forward as a society if we can't even be trusted with our own soul, with our own mind and spirit? This is the amount of respect that's given to the average human. And this is why things remain as they are, because we're not even allowed to explore that. We're not even allowed to have a peek behind the curtain. And those that do take a peek behind the curtain, there's a reason why they talk the way they do. There's a reason why they seem to be so strangely compassionate and so strangely driven to want peace and interconnectedness. What's all this about? There's a reason why, because they saw something. They made the effort to try to see through a new set of eyes. And you realize that things aren't black and white, that the universe is spectacularly huge, unfathomably huge, and we're just a tiny part of it. And just as equally as we are nothing and nobody and on a tiny blue dot in the middle of a cold expanse of space, we are special. We are beautiful. We are individual. We are fantastic. And equal parts, humility and pride in that regard are integral to us having love for each other, and but also wanting to explore and do good stuff for once. I don't know. That's quite the rant.
That's all right. Rant away. You know, when you're sitting there talking about like the scale, like we're just on this little blue dot, in the middle of nowhere. Well, really, when you look at this is relativity in a way. It says, oh, look how small we are. We're insignificant. But scale really should have nothing to do with it in the universe, because think about how small a cancer cell is or whatever, right? It's microscopic. You can't even see it. And yet that thing can take control of your entire world. So it's really importance and significance to me is beyond scale.
Yes.
I think, personally, I would say that I probably got that from a psychedelic experience,
And it's funny, you hear people, like the guy who played JR on TV, I think he's passed away now. I was watching some interview with him on TV, and he just busted out and was like, yeah, I did LSD in the 70s, and man, it changed my life. I understood things in a new way, and I'll never be the same. I understand that I'm connected to everyone else, and that what I do affects everyone else, and that I should be thoughtful and mindful about the way I behave. And
what was the response of the person interviewing
them? They were just like, oh.
Aghast.
Yeah, because it's...
You're not supposed to talk about that stuff.
Those barriers are broken down. But even the biggest apologists for these sort of things have been lampooned and sort of turned into cartoon characters, somewhat because of their own behavior, and also because it's what else can you do? That's the only way you can discredit someone, is to lampoon them and make an attack. And nobody's perfect, so it's easy. You pick the flaw that person has, and you're good to go. Now they're no longer credible. Hunter S. Thompson liked guns, and he liked to drink a lot. So his perspectives on politics and psychedelics and the way that people were, and his thoughts on Nixon and his thoughts on war must not have any relevance, because he was an alcoholic and he liked guns. Right?
So I just heard somebody said Randall Carlson, that was the same thing, that basically, like, I think he was on the Joe Rogan Experience or whatever, and he was talking about science and everything, and somebody was saying, oh, well, this guy's just an old hash head. You don't have to listen to him. It's like, wow, what a perspective, huh?
Right. And if we were to turn the tables, what's this guy's bag?
Exactly. Yeah.
I guarantee you that if we wanted to play that game, we could play it all day long, because it's just, we're all a bunch of Don Quixotes, tilting at windmills, but really tilting at straw men. And this is hard, because when you get in an argument, you have a tendency, everyone has a tendency to want to throw in a couple of little fun jabs, and then you get away from actual discourse. And I think this is why the Socratic method of posing questions is good. You can say things that really get to the meat of things by asking questions. But is it not true that so-and-so said this? Right? That's the way that they...
Yeah, yeah.
That method is good, because you're not pointing a finger, you're not making an assertion. You may have a view, but it shows at least... a modicum of humility in posing that perhaps you're wrong and perhaps you don't know enough on the subject, and please enlighten me. I find that it's especially irksome to me because of my background. Anytime that I hear somebody screaming and ranting that what they think is the only way, or it absolutely has to be done this way, there are very few instances that actually is true. And so what you have with the rest of these people are people that are peddling their own BS. They don't like other people's BS, but they want to promote theirs. So there you have it. So how do we get past all of this? This is really kind of where I want to go with it.
I was literally just going to ask you that.
Where do we go with this? And this is one of the other reasons why I posed the way that I put together the quest for Gnosis was, what do we do? How do we fight this beast? Philip K. Dick was a science fiction author He wrote Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep, which ended up being the feature film Blade Runner. Mm-hmm. He wrote Minority Report. He wrote Total Recall. He wrote A Scanner Darkly and several other books and things that came to film. And he wrote an entire cosmology. And for those who don't know what a cosmology is, basically his view of the world, his theological view of the world. And in it, he talked about the Empire. And he spoke about the Empire as in a control system that is kind of difficult to define, but it is an attitude, it is a way, it is in many ways the spirit of the true Antichrist, if you view Christ as a symbol of compassion and love and humanity saving itself from that perspective. The spirit of Antichrist is one of saying one thing and doing the other, saying you're of peace but being of war, so on and so forth. That's a direct definition. But in this exegesis that Philip K. Dick wrote, he talked about this empire being one that if you attack it by its own means, you become the empire. Mm-hmm. So when we, for instance, you and I do media stuff, if one of us became horrendously popular, right? Well, we're no longer the bad guys in the media that we might speak against. We are the bad guys of the media that someone else is speaking against, and we are creating monsters, so to speak, in that regard. And this is how, in terms of what we do, we can see ourselves becoming the empire, right? By overthrowing an evil government, right, by war, we become the next evil government.
Sure.
Che Guevara was, you know, if you ever watched like the Motorcycle Diaries, great film.
Yeah.
Young Che Guevara, and you see, wow, he really cared. He wanted to be a doctor. But something changed in him, and he became the empire. His ideals took him to a violent place because at some point he changed, and this is how we all are. And this is, you know, the archetypal voyage where Luke Skywalker, for instance, is, you know, he's like almost going to turn to the dark side, and you know what I mean, like in the sure. film you're like worried, is he going to turn? Oh my goodness, he's going to turn, and he doesn't. Mm-hmm. But all of us are going to come to that point, and I see this a lot in new media. In the internet, we begin to do the very things that we despise in others. I was just watching this thing with Sean Hannity and Russell Brand going back and forth. And Sean Hannity's style of accusation and calling people names, or saying things like, why can't you get this through your thick head? Like, sure. Saying things in a very accusatory fashion and calling people names. That sets a precedence that it's not an open discourse, that it's just a pissing match of sorts. And this happens among a lot of people, you know, who are trying to do the good fight, right? But by using the same strategies in that regard, we become the next bad guy. And it's very difficult doing what we do, because unless we tackle our own monsters, our own demons, our own insecurities, our own fears and biases, we are really in a tough position. And again, I'm really glad that I was humbled and horrified and humiliated and put through the mud when I left Christianity, because hopefully it will have continued to provide me with that humbling experience of knowing that I am flawed, and that I need other people, that I need help, that I can't do this on my own, and that all of my views aren't perfect, that I need to constantly be in flux. And I think that that's a great example of how we need to make sure that we understand that the universe is not standing still. We're all in this sort of meta-reality in which things are constantly changing and morphing, and politics are different than they were 10 years ago, and kids are different than they were 10 years ago. You know, I have an 11-year-old and a 13-year-old, and they have access to information. And I joke with them, I'm like, you know, when I was a kid and I had a question, I would have to hope that I remembered that question for a week or two when I had the chance to go to the library and go through the Dewey Decimal System and the cards to find a book that's on the subject that hopefully if I read the whole book, I might get the answer to or might not. Now they Google a question and the answers are there, and there's 1,000 different opinions, 1,000 different versions, 1,000 different stories. And so
at this moment in time, discourse is the most important thing because of how much information we have.
And really, humility and compassion have to be the benchmarks of discourse. Otherwise, it's just like everything else. It's just like politics. It's just like anything else. We might as well be Sean Hannity up there barking at people and calling names and all that. It's completely fruitless.
And humility seems to be one of the lost virtues, I feel, too. And I think that this is one of the main things that you gain when you go through, a process of personal rebirth, discovering one's true self, you know, coming to these realizations. I mean, this is understood in alchemy as turning lead into gold. You know, we could see it, and the metaphor of being reborn through Christ. Of course, this is the mystical being reborn through Christ. But yes, this is one of the main things that you gain, and I think it's one of the most important things that we can do. It's that ego dissolution, gaining that humility.
And once that happens, once that experience happens, and again, honestly, I sought this experience. I sought this with my time as a Christian, and it never came. And it came with psilocybin, and it came with DMT the most powerfully. Was that I don't fear death. I know that there's love in the universe, but I also know that the universe is looking for me to do things more expediently. It's not interested in my weird moral hang-ups. It's interested in expedience, efficiency, mm-hmm. but from a love perspective, but a very clinical, strange way in which it's like, yeah, Gabe, you should stop drinking because it's not expedient. Well, is it bad? No, it's not bad. It's not expedient. It's not the best way for you to get to where you're trying to go. And we need you to get to where you're trying to go. We need everybody to get where they're supposed to go. Hmm. But we got to do this one person at a time. So you got to do this.
So where is that?
That place?
Yeah.
That place where I stopped trying to feed the monster with people, with things, with Facebook likes, with YouTube thumbs ups, with the approval of my peers, with anything like that, where I realized that this life is a training ground and it is an education, and that if I'm living this life with anything other than a wide-eyed wanderlust and an openness to continue to learn and a humility to not be a jerk to people, that I'm going to miss out. I don't want to miss out. And I definitely don't want to have to take the same test twice. I would hate to have to relive everything that I've lived again. I think once is enough. And I believe that some form or kind of reincarnation is quite possible or probable. And so I don't want to have to do this again. I want to pass the test correctly the first time around.
Do you think that's the meaning to life? Is to get to that place, find that place, so you don't have to come back? Because that's what you were alluding to.
I think the core of the meaning of life is truly love. To learn to love in all circumstances, to learn compassion and care, and to learn to operate in creativity. I believe that creation, whether it's art, whatever it is that we do, I think that's the integral aspect. And creation and coming together as a group of people, there's this great thing that they say in the book of Genesis during the building of the Tower of Babel. And back then, God speaks as a myriad, as many people, and says, if these people continue working together, there's nothing that they cannot accomplish. so let us disperse them, right? Let us disperse them. So just in that, you have many ideas that I think are integral to this concept. And the reason, one more reason why I think that this concept of Jehovah is an evil concept. One, God is myriad, even in the Old Testament. And it actually in the Midrash commentary to the Old Testament, or to the first five books of the Old Testament, it describes God as a hermaphrodite. That's why it says, let us make man in our own image, both man and woman.
Mm-hmm.
And that's from the Midrash. That's the commentary. So there's that. But then there's this insidious idea, one of many insidious ideas in Genesis. They're accomplishing too much. There's nothing that they won't be able to do if they're together. So let's separate them. And this right here, alluding back to Philip K. Dick's Empire, that's the spirit of the empire. There is something, maybe it's metaphor, maybe it's real, that seems to be lording over us, wanting us to not be together, wanting us to be subjected and subdued. And from the Gnostic perspective, you see that this God from the Old Testament is actually evil, and is a vampire of sorts that feeds off either your devoted worship or your fear. Either way, it's feeding off of you. So it's very interesting, this idea of togetherness and unity, again, is very anti, it's very much against modern Christian monotheistic perspective, because unity is seen as you know, a new world order of sorts, right? Mm-hmm. It's seen as, I know what this means. You want to dominate us all and tax us and all that stuff. But I don't think that that's what the Dalai Lama is promoting. I don't think that's what the Dalai Lama is trying to say when he's like, we need to understand our interconnectedness. We need to understand that all of this material stuff is an illusion, that the only thing that we might possibly carry on is our love and the love that we've dispersed and the compassion that we've given out. This is the thing. And again, because of our biases, we can't even see that. We can't even see the forest for the trees to say, hey, oh, that's right, we should stop murdering people for money, and we should stop condoning our governments doing it and saying it's okay because our government's doing it. Like, we should stop that.
Yeah.
We should understand our interconnectedness. And
yeah, why is it okay when the government kills somebody, but if you kill somebody, it's not okay? That doesn't make any sense.
In the Bible, it says that we need to be true to our nation. That's why.
Which unfortunately is interpreted that way.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, obviously, this is a mystical book, and when they say nation, they don't mean, you know, the United States of frickin' America, right? You know,
right.
They're talking in a much more symbolic, much more, you know, mystical way.
Well, there is it's very important, and I need to be very clear that I love all people, and if anyone has heard what I'm saying, if they've understood me correctly, what I'm trying to say is that we are people. We all have hunger. We all want sex. We all want to eat good food. We all want to have a sunny day with people that we care about. We all want to have nice things. Every single human that's living wants that. And we have to understand that that has to be the very core of who we are. And so when we put these dividing lines through our ideologies and through our beliefs, we need to understand that if our beliefs are telling us that, that our beliefs are probably messed up. Because it's our core being. Babies are born smiling. They, you know, they come out and they don't have any reason to smile. Why are you smiling? I don't know. I'm a baby. But they got love, right?
Yeah.
They have this innocence and this joy. And, you know, I think us coming closer to humbling ourselves and ridding of ourselves of all of this stuff that we're so hung up by is really key. And, you know, I don't know if what people may or may not know about me, but I've given up all of my belongings. I have a laptop and some clothes. I'm homeless. Like, I'm actually homeless. I have several places that I stay, but I have no address. And
do you feel more at home now?
No.
No?
No, in many ways I feel more free, but I'm not homeless because I did anything terribly wrong or anything like that. It's just this is where my path has brought me for this time and place.
Sure.
It will change. But I had to give up a lot in order to get here, to learn the things that I needed to learn. And what are we willing to do? What are we willing to do? Who are we without our stuff, without our cool clothes? Who are we without our friends?
That's interesting that you're saying that, man, because there's been several times, and I've talked to several people about this too, you know, that in my own life where I completely abandoned all my material possessions, like literally lived out of my car.
And right. And when we do that, it's not noble, so to speak. It's just a new perspective. It's just another form of gnosis. And this is the great thing, is when we look at every experience, whether it's good or bad, as a chance to understand better, we're good. I didn't care a single thing, really, actually, for homeless people until I experienced a night out in the cold. And then I understood.
Yeah.
And people don't understand because they haven't experienced it.
And that night was a Gnostic experience.
It was absolutely a Gnostic experience. And when I woke up the next day, I was a bigger man than I was earlier. Yeah. I wasn't superior, just I had learned something new and had grown.
You're a better Gabriel Roberts, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Hey, we only got about three or four minutes left here, and I just want to kind of cover where you're headed next. I know that you're working on your new book. You have three books out right now, Riding the Fine Line, Born Again to Rebirth, and then The Quest for Gnosis, and you're working on The Hermit right now?
That's correct.
Okay, and then you're also going to be speaking at the Matter and Psyche Symposium, right?
Yes, I'm speaking at the Matter and Psyche Symposium. It's in Joshua Tree in California, out in the desert. It is gorgeous out there, and I'll be speaking with Rupert Sheldrake and Graham Hancock, and many, many other fantastic speakers. If anyone can make it out, it's September 12th through the 14th. You can go pick up tickets at matterpsyche.net. And I'm going to be there. It's going to be super fun. I'm very much looking forward to it. And my book, The Hermit, is the story of what I've been doing, what I've been going through and what I've been learning. And it's been really brutal and really hard, but it is beautiful. It's going to be the best thing I've ever done. And if the Quest for Gnosis as is presently available, is kind of the map, then the Hermit is the territory, is actually going through it.
Walking up the mountains, right?
Yeah, literally.
And then coming back down too.
Coming down the mountain.
That's awesome. Well, that's great, man. I hope you enjoyed the symposium, man. That's quite an honor to be here.
Yeah, I'm super excited.
Yeah. So, well, cool, man. Thanks so much for talking with me again. I really appreciate it, dude. I enjoyed our last conversation. I wish I could have recorded both, but this one was just good. So I really appreciate it, man. So, do you want to leave the listeners with anything?
I would just like to say, if you want to find me, go to GabrielDRoberts.com. All of my social media connections are there. You can find me on Facebook really easily. Just punch in Gabriel D. Roberts. It's the guy who looks like he's got a white beard and nerdy glasses, and that's me.
Cool, man. Well, thanks, man. And let's talk again in the future, and we'll check in and see where else you're at, maybe in like a few months or something like that.
That sounds awesome.
All right. Thanks, man.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye. Thanks so much for listening, everyone. Our outro song is called When the Sea Turns to Desert, Sand, and Salt, and is provided by the Southern Wisconsin band The Fingers. The Fingers recently won the Madison Area Music Award for Best Country Bluegrass Record, and this song is off their first record entitled The Best of The Fingers. You can find them on iTunes as well as on www.lukascatalog.com. That's Loukas catalog.com. On the next few episodes of the Marty Leeds Math Magical Radio Hour, we'll feature author, inventor, and bloody damn good sailor Crichton E. Miller, conspiracy comedians The Joy Camp, as well as Court Lindahl, Randy Powell, Randall Carlson, Ezra Sanzer Bell, and many others. Be sure to stay tuned, and always remember, an opinion without pie is just an onion. Thanks.
When the night sky fades to white, I'll be watching with one eye. When the big crowd gathers round, who wants to throw us down? We'll be shifting. When the air gets to be in the rain, I'll be sending you the north wind from a redwood tree. And the stars will send a smile that you'll feel all the while when it's dusty and it's solstice to the sea.
Been listening to the Marty Leeds Mathmagical Radio Hour. More information about the work of Marty Leeds can be found at MartyLeeds33.com. You can download his full-length studio record, Opus Medico Musica, from iTunes or Amazon.com, and be sure and check out his books, Pi and the English Alphabet, Volume 1 and 2, and The Peacock's Tales, available at MartyLeeds33.com and Amazon. For hours of free video, check out his YouTube channel at MartyLeeds33. More information about SyncBook Press, SyncBook Radio, or SyncBook Events can be found at thesyncbook.com. If you like this podcast, please support it by becoming a donor. You'll find the donation links under each episode on the website and consider setting up a monthly charge. Thanks so much, and though some people think it's a piece of cake, we all know it's easy as pie.